respond in part to some questions Cornell raised, which he would consider crucial, and then open it for about 20 minutes of discussion. And then we're going to take a few moments to deal with where we're going to go in terms of this afternoon and tomorrow before we break for lunch.
Cornell raised some most penetrating questions, and what I'd like to do now is simply give some background information for the discussion that relates to three points that he raised, which to me are the most crucial ones. One is the definition of religion and whether that is so amorphous or wide-ranging that it uses all its utility, and likewise the slipperiness of the concept of humanism. With respect to both of these, let me indicate that what I was trying to give are phenomenological definitions. Phenomenological descriptions within operated definitions rather than giving stipulated definitions. I'm saying when I look at the area of religion, if you inspect the area of things that are called religion, what you will find there is the concept of salvation.
Bill, repeat that.
Yes.
You said if.
What I'm saying is identify the objects that are called religion. And then a phenomenological description is an attempt to find out what common features, if any, you find there. And I'm saying what I find common is this principle of salvation, some soteriological program. And as I explained to Cornell later, I think it's easy to show that every individual has such a program. Even the nihilist has one. Not everyone has a theistic one. Not everyone has a concept of God. But in order to exist, as Camus says, to breathe is to value. So there is no way to live without some value system which says that certain things are more important than others, which enables you to rank and give meaning to some kind of to your existence. So, if that is not an accurate description, if that is not what is common to religions, then I'm more than willing to change it. I just don't see anything else there that can adequately account for the things that are called religion. Soteriology, I'm still willing to say, is the centering principle of religion, phenomenologically interpreted or looked at. Now, with respect to humanism, I want to interpret that phenomenologically as well. And these are the differences that I see between humanism and theism. Now, there are essentially, well, four. But let me just, only three are important for our discussion. Humanism has a certain theory or concept of authority. It's the concept of authority that I have called functional ultimacy. Another way of putting it is that humanism acknowledges, preaches, affirms as its explicit concept of authority or operating principle the claim that man is the measure of all things. That principle, man the measure of all things, I'm saying, is the acknowledged principle of humanism. I'm also willing to argue that I can show that theism with respect to authority also operates on the same principle. Doesn't acknowledge it, but I'm saying it works on that principle. So the difference to me is not that the principle is present in humanism and absent in the other. The difference is that it is acknowledged in one and not acknowledged in the other. All I'm saying is this. Christians or theists will say that God is ultimate authority, or Scripture is ultimate authority, or Christ is ultimate authority. But in the final analysis, the justification for that, the demonstration for that, is ultimately some principle of man to measure, some principle of subjectivity. If it's not that, then demonstrate that the Bible, it ought to be authoritative. In the final analysis, you're going to be reduced to some kind of faith principle. So I'm saying theism, humanism, operate on it. It's acknowledging one and not the other. Second difference. Theism and humanism have a different concept of soteriology.
Okay.
In theism, soteriology operates this way. Once you have identified ultimate reality, however you want to define it, and that will differ from system to system. But once you have identified ultimate reality, only one response is permitted or is allowed. Namely, conformity to ultimate reality. Obedience to God, conformity to God's will, and so forth, is what is outlined as the appropriate or essential pattern of salvation. Nonconformity to God's will and purpose is not allowed to be a sociological program. Right, now, humanism allows for nonconformity to ultimate reality as a sociological program. It doesn't necessitate, but it does allow for it. Let me give you an example of this in terms of the Old Testament. Two myths. Adam and Eve have a commandment. Don't eat the tree of good and evil. They go ahead and do it. And Christian faith, biblical faith, interprets that as sin. Not salvation, but sin. Bad. Worst thing that happened to humanity. Greek myth of Prometheus. Zeus tells Prometheus not to do something. Prometheus does it anyway. That is, rebels against the divine, non-conforms to ultimate reality. How is that regarded? Good. Authentic. I'm saying that's the kind of distinction that I see with respect to humanism and theism. All right, now, with respect to sociology, the third difference that I see when I look at the systems has to do with the way they define the character of ultimate reality. Theism defines ultimate reality as essentially benevolent, as good, as supportive of humans, highest human ideals and so forth. Humanism allows that ultimate reality can be either demonic or indifferent. Now here again, it appears to me that you have something of this picture in both the Promethean and the Demic myths. Prometheus feels that Zeus's reason or motivation for not giving fire to humanity is bad. It's immoral. And because Prometheus does not regard Zeus as moral, Prometheus disobeys. That is, nonconformity is based on a judgment of God's character as not being ideal or so forth. Now, to me, there's an inkling of the very same principle in the Old Testament. What does the serpent say to Adam and Eve to motivate them to eat the tree of good and evil? The serpent tells them that if you do this, what will happen to you? You will become like God. Now, what I hear the serpent saying is this. The reason why God doesn't want you to eat the tree of good and evil is that God is trying to protect his or her prerogatives. God's got a selfish intent here. Now, if that's their understanding of God's motive or motivation, then it appears to me that their response, namely nonconformity or rebellion, is analogous to Prometheus. But all I'm saying, those are the three basic differences that I see between humanism and theism. If I identify a fourth, it would be this. I do think there's a fundamental difference in the experiences. Theists have an experience of something that they call God, and humanists simply don't. I don't regard myself as theist because I simply have not had any such experience that I think I can appropriately say is an experience of the divine. So those are the only four differences that I think I can. Now those are phenomenological differences. In that regard, I don't think it's a slippery term. The three figures that Cornell mentioned to me could easily be fitted under that rubric, except Maritain. Now Maritain's true humanism, to me, is really a form of theism. If you look at the phenomenological definition I gave you, the description that I just identified, the sociological system, the concept of authority, all of that that's involved there is a form of theism. So though Maritain talks about true humanism, his operative position, I think, can only be regarded as one of theism. Right, now the other point that I'd like to raise had to do with the reference to humanism as self-confident. That's not my characteristic or a normal way of talking about humanism, and I would not in any way want to reduce humanism to self-confidence. I think that's a denial of humanism. Humanism talks about the functional ultimacy of humanity, not the ontological ultimacy. Humanism is not saying that human beings are the highest or the best. It's not saying that they are the most powerful. In fact, they tend to affirm just the opposite. Human beings are finite creatures. Look at the myth of Sisyphus. Sisyphus does not overcome ultimate reality. Sisyphus, as it were, loses out in terms of trying to oppose ultimate reality. But he does it anyway. Humanism is not reduced to the actualization of human desires, human concerns. It merely says that in certain areas, human beings have to act as if they were ultimate, though ontologically speaking, they are not. Self-confident humanism in the paragraph that Cornell referred to was an attempt to harken back to this point here. I was trying to say that humanism materially surfaces in those cultures where human beings do in fact exert a certain amount of control and authority over nature and reality. I'm saying that the fact that they have been able to actualize that much authority gets translated in a certain kind of theological position or philosophical position. But that should not be interpreted in the sense that self-confident means that human beings are able to do anything or accomplish any goals. I am not, my position is in no way wedded to the feature of self-confidence as a defined principle of humanism. I don't want to stick with the phenomenological description that I gave.
We will open now for general discussion for a few minutes. Noah?
Yes, I want to thank both Professor West and Professor Jones for the illuminating discussion, and to especially thank Professor Jones for the compelling nature of the presentation. I find it sort of indisputable at the moment that soteriology is indeed the centering principle of religion and humanism. The question that broaches for me, Professor Jones, is what does it mean to be saved for black religion and for black humanism?
Part of the amorphous character of the concept of soteriology, which is another point that I think Cornell raised, is that I cannot identify the content of a sociological system until you give me a concrete religion. You give me a concrete religion or a concrete system, and then I can give it flesh at that point. All I'm trying to do is to describe a form, a pattern, and the form or pattern is soteriology, but I am not giving any content to it except salvation means, in some sense, whatever the individual defines as his or her highest good. It's another way of talking about summum bonum or so forth. Now, obviously, that will differ from religion to religion. If you push me, there really isn't a single soteriological program that I can say is common to all humanists. If I were to speak generally, I think it would say something like this. Humanism advances a program that is similar to a doctrine of self-realization in the sense that it tries to have the human being exercise the fullest extent of human nature, which is human freedom. Humanism, to me, also accents a concept of salvation which attempts to make the definition of human being as freedom the basis for social, economic, and political institutions. That is, to the degree to which the individual actualizes that freedom which is his or her nature, and or the degree to which this principle gets incarnated and institutionalized in our culture or society, to that degree it appears to me that humanists say, we are in the ideal situation. We are in the best situation.
Could you give us a definition of soteriology?
I'm simply saying salvation. I'm simply saying the highest good, the ideal situation, the authentic situation, that which is the norm. That is to say, if you ask an individual, on what basis do you do this, or why do you do this, he gives you an answer, and then you say, why do you do that, and then they give you an answer. At some point, the individual has to say, I do all of that on the basis of this, and I can't go any further. That is, they're operating on the basis of some ideal picture, some norm or something, which becomes the centering principle of their existence, of their of their concept of what is best for me.
Well, then can you conceive of human existence without some kind of soteriological evaluation?
That's what I said earlier. I don't think you can. Mm-hmm. Even the nihilist, I can verbalize nihilism, but the nihilist can never put nihilism into practice consistently. Nihilism put into practice consistency leads to suicide. Camus raised the point to me very, very well, and in The Myth of Sisyphus, when he says that the ultimate philosophical question is suicide. And he's really trying to address those, trying to show that there is a basis for refuting nihilism. The nihilist ultimately says that everything is equivalent. Nothing is better than anything else. Now, Camus tries to counter that argument in this way. If nothing is better than anything else, then living is not better than dying. Suicide is not better than living. Okay, now if the nihilist says nothing is better than anything else, then the nihilist has to make a choice at every moment of his or her waking life to commit suicide or not to commit suicide. No way the nihilist can avoid that, to commit suicide or to continue to live. All right, now, if everything is equivalent, what is the basis on which the nihilist can make the decision? It has to be something like a chance or a flipping coin basis. Otherwise, the nihilist is operating on some principle that something is better than something else. All right, now, if he ain't cheating, or if he doesn't have a two-headed coin, suicide eventually comes up. So what he is arguing is that if you've got a nihilist who is espousing nihilism and still continues to exist, they ain't consistent nihilists. So no, I have no problem with the conclusion. In fact, I make it in other places. As Luther said, everybody has a God. I would prefer to say that everyone has a religion. Everyone has a soteriological perspective. I don't want to reduce it to God. I don't think everybody's a theist. But I think you can operate without having a God. I don't think you can operate without having some kind of hierarchy of values.
Isaac and then Larry.
I have two questions that are different. If I understood you correctly, you indicated that black philosophy is not a philosophy that emerges in response to traditional philosophy, and you rejected logical positivism as an appropriate way of talking about black philosophy. I would like for you to explain the implicit metaphysics or ontology of black philosophy and differentiate it from white philosophy.
Well, here again, what I'd have to do, as I attempt to do, is pick out some concrete objects that I'm willing to argue are black philosophy and show how they're different. As Cornell rightly again indicated, it's very difficult to identify any breadth of philosophical system that have been or can appropriately be labeled black. But I'm making a distinction between black philosophy and black philosophers. There are black philosophers who are logical positivists. I don't want to deny that. But black philosophy to me is that philosophy that that emerges out of attempts to articulate and express the continuing and our controlling features of black life or black experience.
Now
I'm saying the best expression I have of that, if you want to look at philosophy, if you want to look at philosophy in terms of the standard definition, that is the definition that's defined by virtue of the Christian, Christocentric perspective, you want to talk about it in that way, religious humanism, Afro-American religious humanism, to me is your best example.
Now, are you willing to suggest philosophically in a similar way as you suggested religiously, that logical positivism has an implicit ontology?
Logical positivism does have an implicit ontology. It has an implicit epistemology. Implicit anthropology. Yes, I don't have any problem with that. Yes. I think that there are a number of books that I think spell it out very, very clearly. It's impossible. Well, Paul Tillich said the same thing in terms of systematic one. It's simply impossible to operate in terms of making epistemological decisions without presupposing an anthropology or ontology or something. There's something is implicit there, yes.
But isn't it necessary then for you to make explicit the implicit ontology of black philosophy?
Oh, yeah, okay, all right, yes. The implicit anthropology of black philosophy to me would be this. It has something, it says something about human beings in terms of freedom. It accents human beings with respect to freedom. I think that's implicit in its criticism of opposing points of view, and it's implicit in the ideal that I think it advances. If I reduce it to a concrete category, it would say something about the individual as a co-equal center of freedom, authority, and value. That to me is the operational anthropology. Co-equality of the individual with respect to freedom, authority, and value is the operational anthropology of religious humanism, and I would also say black philosophy. The ontology, is difficult to identify, as I was again saying during the break, because we simply don't have reams and reams of material coming from a single thinker or from a group of thinkers which describes substantial parts of their thought. All we got are little bits and pieces. So it just, it's impossible to take those little pieces and say, because he says it's here, because they question the existence of God, then that enables us to say something about something else on the other side. It's just not the materials that make those kinds of claims. So whatever I want to say about ontology with respect to black philosophy, it has to be an inference for some concrete feature like the implicit concept of anthropology.
But why assume there's such a thing as ontology? I mean, that seems to be a presupposition. We're looking for an ontology. Why assume there's such a thing? What makes you think that there is an ontology?
I'm talking about ontology as a view of reality. I think everybody operates on such a view. I simply think that everybody has a worldview, and that's an implicit feature of their worldview. We're on a fourth floor building. We go out there rather than there. Now, that tells me something about our understanding, the basis, what our understanding, the way reality operates.
But science, the
Newtonian. All right, I'm saying, for some people, their view of reality can be reduced to that of the scientific view of reality. Not everybody would be reduced that way.
Well, at that moment, ours is. The very reason why we don't walk out because we believe in
But I don't think that's a total view of reality or ontology of everybody here. I mean, because in addition to saying something about the laws of nature and so forth, they would also want to say something about a transcendent entity, a transcendent agency or figure or process, which science would not talk about or affirm. So here again, I don't think there's any necessary common feature to all concepts of reality, but I'm saying everybody has one, and you can deduce it from the way they act. Their actions to me are always consistent with a certain understanding of reality.
Their fruit cease to know.
Larry?
I suppose I stand with what I think I hear implied in some of the questions of others in terms of lack of clarity in your use of terms. For instance, you described ontology as a worldview.
Part of a worldview.
Ontology, cosmology. But ontology had to do with view of being rather than a view of the world. It seemed to be a similar unclarity with soteriology. Why would one define striving toward an ideal as soteriology, soteriology comes from the word having to do with to be saved, being saved from something to something. But that's not the same as striving toward an ideal. They can intertwine with one another, but they're not the same as one another. It comes as a problem for me when you say that soteriology, that is, being saved from something to something, is the centering point of all religion, when, as far as I can ascertain it, African religion and other pre-modern religions, many of them, do not have a concept of salvation. That's not a part of their operative religious framework. The African does not strive, African traditional religion does not strive for any salvation from some negative reality or even to some negative reality, positive reality. Nor does it assume that there's something fundamentally wrong with humans and seek to be a corrective of it. So I'm not sure how I think I disagree with the notion that soteriology and a view of something wrong with humans are endemic to all religions, because certainly they don't seem to apply to African or Native American religions or many others.
I think they do, but let me try to explain that. But you added a dimension to the definition that I did not add, and I did not want to add. I did not say anything about that soteriology is reduced to being saved from something to something.
But that's in the word itself. You're taking one word and giving another content to
it. No, what I'm saying is
too raw, too sloppy.
Well, it can be sloppy, but what I'm saying is there is no necessity to say that you have to define a word as you're doing it simply by looking at the etymology of it. The etymological definition need not be the controlling definition of the word. So there are systems which talk about being saved from something to something, but I am not making that the controlling definition or the centering principle of soteriology. One other dimension. The accent that I was trying to make was not simply striving after an ideal, but it is striving after an ideal which is defined as ultimate.
That's what I mean. The ideal is the ultimate.
I'm saying, when you've got that, when you say that your highest good, your well-being, when you say that it is indispensable for you to achieve or attain or relate to that ideal, that to me is salvation. That's the functional definition of it. Now, how does this relate to African religion? Now, I think it is helpful. I have no problem with this. You can talk about two different kinds of soteriology. I was operating in a predominantly Western context, and this is the one that's most prominent there, but that is to talk about salvation as corrective. You can also talk about salvation as preventive. Again, talk about preventive medicine. The presupposition of preventive medicine is that something fundamentally wrong can come about, and our concern is to keep that from coming about, or if it does come about, then we have to introduce the corrective. Now, it's easy to show that African religion has a view which says something like this. The ideal situation is for the human being to have a certain kind of relation with reality, ultimate reality. Now, as long as that relationship is maintained and attained and maintained, then things are right. We're in a situation of the good, the idea, how you want to put it. Now, when that is upset, when that kind of harmony, or how you want to put it, is upset, runs afoul, then there are very clear cut corrective measures designed to regain or to restore that kind of previous harmony. Now, so again, if you push me, and I've already defined it in another context in this way. Salvation is another way of talking about the appropriate or proper relation that defined as ultimate between the human being and reality and or his fellow human beings. Now, I'm saying that general description of soteriology will cover, I think, every religion that you pull forth. And I don't think that's slippery. Now, see, what I'm saying is, that's a phenomenological description. If you make it any more concrete, what you do by that is automatically eliminate certain things which carry the label religion. Make it concrete, I've got to go to a particular religion.
Okay, we have about 5 more minutes. Borkin and then Charles.
Yeah, this, I want to bring to your attention that this word, soteriology, it comes from the two words. One is to save, and the other one is to keep. Now, this, I don't know whether there is the idea of being saved from something. I don't think that's it. You know, I think that's a kind of Christianizing, or that you are saved from something to something. The idea is safekeeping. And now you can safekeep yourself, or you can have
safekept.
Yeah, you can safekeep yourself, or you can. Or the Christian concept is that there is one who comes outside and come in, and that one is the safekeeper.
Keeping safe implies necessarily saving from some negative.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily.
Why would you want to save? What does saving mean? It means there's something negative that might happen that I want to keep it safe from.
It might happen, but as long as it doesn't happen, you're in a preventive.
But it includes that necessarily in the very definition of it. Saving from some potential negative.
All right,
but
the more you push that, then you collapse your definition of soteriology back into the corrective model, which is what I thought you were rejecting in the first place.
Could I indicate this little text from Philippians? This is 3:20 in Philippians.
Read the Bible.
This is Greek text. Okay, this is out of from whom this, Paul has talked about. We are citizens of heaven. And he says, from whom or from which we welcome or we expect a safekeeper, the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall transform our bodies. Now, this is what you call the person who looks for a safekeeper to come to do something that normal people would generally do themselves, safekeep themselves. And I think you're talking about two things, an otherworldly perspective. And I would think that either in the African tradition, that would not be the case. It would be that you are the safekeeper. Now, that doesn't mean that you are trying to save yourself from something. You're not, safekeeping is the way that things should be, you know, and then you can prevent it. You know, there is preventive, and implicit in the safekeeping is the preventive and the corrective.
The bottom line of the safekeeping is a harmonious relationship.
That's
you
good.
And something.
Well, that doesn't necessarily have to be the ultimate. I mean, not in that sense.
Whatever you perceive.
Yeah,
as
that's correct. Yeah.
Okay, Charles.
You carve out a world in which the safekeeping automatically exists.
Charles?
Yeah, right.
I won't comment on that. I was going to. I just wondered if you would offer these varying degrees of humanism that operate in theistic traditions. I'm particularly concerned about our thinking of for example, a Jewish orientation as compared to a Reformed Christian perspective, in which there is a necessary human involvement. I mean, where even God's existence is sometimes referred to as dependent on people who call God's name and that kind of thing. I would want you to. Because I think the point I want to make is I think that humanism in terms of you talked about it, about this freedom, this dimension of freedom and dignity is one of the underpinning or what I see as one of the themes of Black experience. Period.
Yeah.
In that sense, but yeah. I mean, without regard to whether it doesn't have to be anti-theistic to be human.
Yeah. I will allow for that. Mm-hmm. I have already introduced
terminology, and I think a structure that that accommodates that point of view. Though I would still not regard it as humanism. To me, there are two forms of theism. No, I'm quite serious about that. On the one hand, there's what I call theocentric theism, and on the other hand, what I call humanocentric theism. Now, they are both forms of theism. Humanocentric theism is theism. It is not humanism. It is similar. It is more similar to humanism than it is to theocentric theism. But let's run through that a minute. Theocentric theism, to me, carries a sense God's got the whole world in his hands. Nothing happens. A sparrow doesn't fall or anything without God willing it or God's purposing it. That kind of view has an anthropology where human freedom is very muted. It is restricted to very limited areas, and it is restricted primarily to responding as a responsive way to God, but not having any kind of creative capacity to help bring in the kingdom, and it never has the kind of status that you described in certain forms of Jewish thought, that human activity, human choice and decision is a necessary condition for part of God's program. Now, it never has that, right? Now, humanocentric theism accents human freedom. And it accents this because it says that the exercise of that kind of freedom is part of God's will and purpose. And when human beings exercise that kind of freedom, they are conforming to God's will and purpose, which is the definition of theism that I'm operating on. So I'm saying that there is that kind of position in theism. I don't think you have to negate theism in order to have the concept of human freedom that I'm talking about is acknowledged as the centering principle of humanism. What you've got to give up to get that is theocentric theism. And that, to enlarge it one more point, my whole point is you cannot do a theology of liberation in the context of theocentric theism. You've got to move towards humanocentric theism if you want a theistic theology of liberation, because you need that affirmation of human freedom at several different points.
John, and this is the last question we can take. Our time is...
very briefly, Ben. Bill, you were mentioning the role of myth and using myth, and I'm very interested in that because the prevailing, leaving aside psychological explanations in quotation marks of religion, the prevailing anthropological, sociological approach to religion sees myth as a very important primary formative principle. And your beginning point is not the beginning point of the observation. What they say about myth is not that it attempts, I'll say what they do say, they say it's an attempt to explain reality so that it becomes intelligible and capable, therefore, of being passed down and talked about to others. It comes at a number of questions that arise out of the social group. You have highlighted one kind of question which may or may not come up. The question of soteriology may not come up, but when you define it so broadly, yes, it's a part of something that's going to be asked. So I think, just wondering, where do you see, in the context of the Black experience, where do you see the myth-making role as being operative, inoperative, present, not present in the formulation of the Black theistic, humanistic, any of these perspectives? Where are our myth structures that we can go back to look at where we are today?
With respect to certain parts of Black culture, I think those are relatively easy to identify. I think, for instance, that I don't see how you can look at Black culture without seeing spiritual and so forth as not in some ways reflecting a body of mythical material in which Blacks have attempted to address those fundamental, enduring, inevitable questions and give, in a sense, their response to it. Appears to me that one area that we have not looked at sufficiently would be black folklore. There, to me, you've got a whole body of material which is very ripe for research and investigation. With respect to Afro-American religious humanism, I was trying to show that the secular also provides some kind of mythical structure, if you want to interpret it that way. But having said all of that, I think there are areas of black culture for which we simply don't have a body of material that we can turn to and look at to ferret out the kinds of objects that you're talking about. I think that's in part due to the fact that we have not been a written culture for long periods of our time. I think it has to do with something being an oppressed culture. What is preserved relative to an oppressed group is normally that which has some essential connection to the majority group more so than the minority group. I think there's a kind of correlation there. So what is preserved may not necessarily be the most authentic or the most central items that we have, but that's all that we have. And it's precisely because I don't think you can necessarily reach the conclusion because this is what we've got, therefore it is the most authentic and the most valued, precisely because of that reason, I don't think we can take the approach which takes the black past, and by virtue of it being the black past, comes the norm for what you say, do, think, and strategize today. I think that all of that past has to be looked at concretely, contextually, in terms of specific issues and questions that emerge out of our situation. We look at that to see whether it has any relevance or makes any sense. If it does, use it. If it does not, discard it. That's my approach to the thing.
And as difficult as it is,
to have to put an end to this stimulating discussion with a whole host of questions in my own mind that I didn't get a chance to raise because I, unlike Brother Blank, so I refrain from entering into the
Amen.
You have your programs before you. I'd like for you to take a moment, if you will, for us to make some.
It's honest.
Thanks so much. We're old friends. But really, it is really good to be here. I think Kurt may have said to you that the director of continuing education at our seminary, who just hired June 1, is in the hospital with major surgery from cancer. And he and I are about the same age. We finished seminary about the same year. We got about the same size family. Mm-hmm. Began to run down all the different parallels. The only difference is that he's white and I'm black. And he's in the hospital, and I'm here. So in a way, I'm also glad for the opportunity to share with you some reflection that I've done on what I would call the phenomenon of Haley's roots. I was in a conference earlier this week in St. Louis, and I ran across an interesting new word, maybe a new phrase that some of you may have picked up, and it's called OTE, and it means overtaken by the event. We're overtaken by the event. Mm-hmm. And I think people like us, you know, are in the business to make sure that we are not overtaken by events, and we bring the critical factors to maybe ask some hard questions. about what it meant and what is the significance of what's going on. And so hopefully as I look at roots, I'm trying to come with a caution that we will not be overtaken by the event. I'm going to read what I have because I have tried to put down in a rather tight way, knowing that there is need for time, time constraints. So I will read it as I have it. The purpose of this message is to share with you some theological reflections on Alex Haley's historical account of his family entitled Roots. The editors of Newsweek see this saga as simply the tracing of one individual's ancestry, seven generations, to a small West African village, the account of the life of Kunta Kinte and his children's children, down to Haley's own birth. A.O. Edmonds in Library Journal sees Roots as a chronicle of one black family, a panorama of black life in Africa and America, a fascinating account of how one finds his personal past. Jason Berry in Nation sees Roots as one of the great creations of American literature and predicts that like Roots, Kunta Kinte will become an everyman, but unlike any allegorical figure in our written culture. Berry sees in Roots, illustrating in deep detail the historical patterns of slave life beneath the chronicles of white America, the raising heart and tenacious history of a people in captivity. James Baldwin, writing in the New York Times Book Review, though detracted by what he terms Haley's flamboyant Gothic fiction and cursory treatment of his most recent ancestors, states, the passion of Haley's narrative, the sweep of its concept, and its wealth of largely neglected material elevate Roots to an event of social importance, a book that is bold in concept and ardent in execution, one that will reach millions of people and alter the way we see ourselves. This brief survey of the reviews of Roots attests to its literary qualities and significant historical account. They convey the general consensus that Haley's Roots is a significant work of art. His historical account of his family's history meets the criteria of great literature. It is universal in its appeal and timeless in its theme. Its characters are well drawn and presented in careful detail and vitality. His writing style is clear, coherent, and precise. However, there seems to be, to me, a more important dimension of Roots, which these reviews have not addressed, a theological significance in this saga of an American family. And what I'd like to suggest is that there are parallels between the major characters of Haley's Roots and the Old Testament patriarchs, using, again, as some research that I've done, adding Joseph to the group of patriarchs in the Old Testament. The genre of family saga reminds me of the Old Testament patriarchs. Although Haley's saga does not use the Old Testament as his model, a typology can be made. Abraham the father, the man of faith and vision, the man who was the father of a great nation, is the first of the Old Testament patriarchs. He left his family, his friends, his country, and traveled to a far country. Kunta Kinte was also a man of vision and hope. Although he did not leave in response to a divine call, rather, he was snatched away brutally, but he, like Abraham, went to a distant and hostile country. Kunta's obedience, courage, and faith are extraordinary, just as Abraham's were. They are indices of his personhood. His obedience is demonstrated in his refusal to deny his family, country, his tradition, and his God. Kunta obeyed the voice within. He was obedient to what it meant to be human. He was obedient to what it meant to be a son of Allah, of God. He was obedient to the hope that the shackles of slavery would not imprison his mind. He parallels Abraham's obedience as found in Genesis chapter 22, verses 1 to 4, in which the writer states in conclusion, Abraham went out as the Lord had told him. Like Abraham, Kunta also was a man of courage. His constant attempts to escape are pictures of daring fidelity to belief in freedom. Although he knew the odds were against him, he tried anyhow. The picture of Kunta is far into the typical portrait of the docile, ignorant slave. Kunta could have uttered David Walker's impassioned plea, "Yea, would I meet death with avidity, far, far, in preference to such servile submission to the murderous hands of tyrants. God will not suffer us always to be oppressed. Our sufferings will come to an end, in spite of all the Americans, this side of eternity." Abraham's courage is seen in his confrontation with God for Sodom. He put their safety first, Genesis 18:22-33. Kunta's obedience and courage were undergirded by faith, just like Abraham's. Throughout the saga, Kunta is seen as a man of deep faith. He prayed constantly, and even when confronted with disbelievers, he persevered in his faith. Like Abraham, Kunta was a venerable patriarch. Abraham's faith is the reason Israel called him father. Beyond biological linkage, they saw his affirmation of God as the key to his life and his history. To Abraham was given the promised land, the promise of man, prosperity, and posterity. Kunta did not have the experience of God that Abraham had, but in his heart was placed a vision of freedom. This was the dream that he never forgot. The second Old Testament parallel is between Isaac and Kizzy. The second person in this typological study is Kizzy, the daughter of Kunta. Her role is more dramatic than her biblical counterpart, Isaac. In the Hebrew patriarchal narrative, Isaac is passive and more of a background figure. The most dramatic element recorded about him was his witness to his father's demonstration of faith, as recorded in Genesis 22. This is significant because although Kizzy's role in the Kunta saga, although more assertive, focuses upon the believability of her father's faith, Kizzy, the one who's going to stay put, as her name suggests, fulfilled the meaning of her name in a symbolic rather than a physical sense. When her father named her, he was hoping that she would never be sold, that she would stay put with them. However, as it developed, she was sold. But she was the strong force in keeping Kunta's dream alive. She never forgot the words that he shared with her. Just as Abraham must have shared his test from God on top of Mount Moriah with Isaac, Kunta must have shared with Kizzy's the naming ceremony, a ceremony begun centuries prior in the village of Darfur in Gambia, West Africa. Kizzy kept the tradition alive. She was the link in the saga. Just as Isaac must be seen as connecting of the patriarchal narratives, Kizzy, the woman of strong determination, was the one to keep Kunta's dream alive, even to stabilizing Chicken George, the Jacob of the Kunta clan. Of course, the third parallel is between Jacob and Chicken George. The similarity between Jacob and Chicken George is amazing as well as amusing. Both struggled with the claim to sonship. Jacob because he was a second born, and Chicken George because he was the illegitimate child born of sexual assault. Both are ambitious. Jacob struggles to inherit his brother's birthright. His struggle with Laban, his father-in-law. Chicken George was a climber. He finally succeeded in becoming chief cock trainer, ousting the man who taught him. He later confronted his white father in his struggle for freedom. He saw that chicken fighting could be manipulated to his own advantage. Remember Jacob? Both Jacob and Chicken George took long journeys. Both returned for reconciliation to their families and final restoration of peace in the community. When the family reached Henning, Tennessee, Chicken George was there, having purchased their freedom and planned their escape. The reunion here is similar to Jacob's meeting with Esau, as recorded in Genesis chapter 23. the next parallel between Joseph and Tom. The Old Testament parallel continues in that Tom, the son of Chicken George, is the man of wisdom. Like Joseph, he demonstrates the virtues of a wise person. He sees meaning and purpose in an apparently hopeless situation. He endures temptation. He does not repay evil with evil. When given an opportunity to strike back, he refuses. Like Joseph, he looked for the higher purpose. Even when the family wanted to be exclusive and dismiss little George, the poor white boy, he refused and included him as a member of the family. He, like Kunta, Kizzy, and Chicken George, are the patriarchal deliverers in accordance with the Old Testament narratives. Especially in the character of Tom, do we see the characteristics of the person of wisdom. Tom suggests that the way of good is the use of one's own resources and one's own ingenuity. Although Chicken George was able to beat the system through devious ways, he reminds us of Jacob the supplanter, the trickster, that is not the way of wisdom. Tom's wisdom becomes the dominant influence. He demonstrates strength that comes from within, discernment that perceives reality, yet with hope, courage that persists in spite of constant danger. To what effect is the comparison between the Hebrew patriarchs and Haley's ancestors? Old Testament scholars suggest that Israel's storytellers kept their history alive to give them a sense of continuity with the past. They were to be reminded of their roots. Listen to the prescription of an old worship ritual. When you come into the land which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance, and have taken possession of it and live in it, you shall take some of the first of all the fruit of the ground which you harvest from your land that the Lord your God gives to you. And you shall put it in a basket, and you shall go to the place which the Lord your God will choose to make his name to dwell there. And you shall go to the priest who is in the office at that time and say to him, I declare this day to the Lord your God that I have come into the land which the Lord swore to our fathers to give us. Then the priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down before the altar of the Lord your God. And you shall make response before the Lord your God. A wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down into Egypt and sojourned there, few in number. And there he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. And the Egyptians treated us harshly and afflicted us and laid upon us hard bondage. Then we cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers. And the Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with great terror, with signs and wonders. And he brought us into this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And behold, now I bring the first of the fruit of the ground, which thou, O Lord, hast given me. And you shall set it down before the Lord your God, and worship before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice in all the good which the Lord your God has given to you and to your house, you and the Levite and the sojourner who is among you. Deuteronomy 26, 1 through 11. Haley's roots gives not only his family, but all black Americans of African descent a connecting link with the past. To know one's past is the key to one's identity, a key to who one is. It overcomes the void of a mysterious past on a dark continent. Here this pilgrimage removes the mystery. We are proudly the children of Africa. We have a past. The debate between Herskovitz and Frazier is over. Black America's past is in Africa. A country of kings and leaders, noble and free. In identifying their biological forebears, Israel saw how they functioned in the context of choice. They were not always slaves. They did exist as free persons before their years of Egyptian bondage. They knew that they lived as free persons, able to determine their destiny to respond to the meaning of freedom. Thank God for Haley's literary
predecessors, the researchers like Carter G. Woodson, and Charles Wesley, Charles Thompson, and Luther B. Jackson, and others. They plowed the ground. Healy articulates and makes vivid the research of many previous scholars. They provided the tracks his imagination and determination led him to walk thereon. The results, roots. We now can view their actions in the context of choice. To be black is not to be a slave. Also, slavery does not denote inferiority. The Greeks were slaves, the Hebrews were slaves, but they also were free. To see blacks in the context of freedom is to understand blacks as members of the human race, God's creation, God's people. Also, this comparison between the Hebrew patriarchs and roots suggests that in both groups, there were individuals who demonstrated human nobility in the face of seemingly impossible choices. Abraham is the example of great faith, the willingness to sacrifice his only son. Isaac dared to accept his father's faith. Jacob struggled through his own fragmentary self to center on God. Roots seeks an answer to the question as to whether or not we can trace our individual lives to Africa, whether we can have an identification or a direct relationship with Africa. There was an answer to these questions, and there can be an answer to ours also. Haley's ancestral pilgrimage assures us that there was and there can be a context of choice, and that in this context there are good and bad decisions. That Africans demonstrated the highest in human capability as well as the lowest in human depravity. There was a context of free choice before slavery. There are and can be heroes like Kunta, Kizzy, Chicken George, and Tom. More significantly, is our present response to what Haley has presented in his moving saga to be one of response in terms of an emotional response, or are we to develop a hermeneutic of roots in which we will ask the critical questions, what did it mean and what does it mean? Thus far, this paper has addressed the former question. Haley's roots is indicative rather than definitive. His treatment is historical rather than systematic. The challenge for us is to interpret the meaning of this great work. We must address the question, what does this phenomenon mean? D.H. Lawrence writes, it is no use trying merely to modify present forms. The whole great form of our era will have to go. And nothing will really send it down but the new shoots of life springing up and slowly bursting the foundation. And no one can do anything but fight tooth and nail to defend the new schools of life from being crushed out and let them grow. I propose that Haley's treatment requires a new way of looking at the black experience. It affirms the glory of our ancestral past. It celebrates the courage of our ancestors who struggled against slavery, segregation, discrimination, and all types of oppression. It presents the reality of black people walking in the freedom of a new day begun. This work means that we must not look back in anger, but walk forward in hope. Haley's recital of his family heritage and the concomitant celebration of his search reminds me of the furor created by the finding of the original account of Deuteronomy in 621 during the reign of Josiah, king of Judah. The discovery initiated a new era in Israel's history. Biblical scholars refer to this as the Deuteronomic reforms. This was an era of a new understanding of their history and a new commitment to Yahweh. Haley's understanding challenges us to a new understanding of what does it mean to be black in America. We must defend the new shoots of life from being crushed out and let them grow. This is our challenge. Finally, Roots raises two fundamental concerns for each one of us: a sense of self, and more importantly, a sense of self in relationship to God. This is dramatized in Kunta's Naaman's ceremony, when Amaro, his father, having whispered Kunta's name in his ear so that he could be the first to hear it, concluded the ceremony. Carrying little Kunta in his arms, he walked to the edge of the village, lifted up the baby, and with his face to the heavens said softly, "Din kiling the wrong lay, oranta ka itel ti. Behold, the only thing greater than yourself."
Now we will ask Dave to entertain some questions.
That's a lot of imagination, and we can deal with that certainly in talk today about scripture as our primary source for the doing of theology. It's very refreshing how you made the connection, and I also think it's important to turn in on the Old Testament, which has been neglected by a lot of us. Think of what's going on in African independent churches now, the connections they're making with the Old Testament. My main question, though, Dave, concerns your choice of Abram, the connection you make. Wasn't Abram an oppressor, really? I mean, when God called Abram, he was quite a big slave owner himself. And I'm wondering if you haven't chosen an oppressor as sort of leading patriarch. I'm wondering about the, if you don't see some ambiguity there in your choice of a slave owner.
Well, my evidence does not suggest that Abraham was an oppressor. For example, the archaeological finds suggest that he was really nomadic, and that whole group they call Habaru, and a lot of studies have been made about them. They were really wandering people. Now, I think what happens here is that the picture of Abraham might have been like the Ebony magazine, show every black person making $5,000 or more as a millionaire. And I think maybe you have a problem between the later glosses of Abraham and the actual history. I think the archaeological discoveries will show that these were poor people who lived in the kind of a nomadic tradition of going from place to place supporting one another. And I think, and maybe in the paper, I could explain my understanding of Abraham, because I'm seeing Abraham as a part of that tribe, that nomadic group, you know, without power, without money, you know, wanderer, you know. And I think this is why I quoted from the passage in Deuteronomy, because here, Abraham is not glorified. A wandering Aramean was my father, which does for me suggest, you know, no land, no stability, almost like the kind of situation that I grew up in. You know, you make me go to the store 3 or 4 times a week because you didn't have enough money to buy food on track. Now, again, my understanding of the archaeological evidence would suggest to me that Abraham was poor.
And therefore not a slave
owner. Yeah. Another
slave owner,
that's right, not a slave
owner. Yeah, but doesn't scripture say that explicitly, Genesis 14, isn't it? That when Yahweh called him, you know, with his slaves, he went into the covenant.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not look at the
Let me get
there.
Together
yeah.
with you on that, because,
yeah,
I was looking at a massive argument on that, which came up in 1855 at the Synod of the Dutch Reformed Church in New Brunswick, when Dr. Howe made that the point of departure for justifying slavery, you know, big.
Does someone have a
thing,
text
so
here of the Old Testament? Maybe we need to look.
Yeah, so.
You know, well,
yeah.
The point is that I know the argument is in the 1850s that Abraham might have had slaves, but he did not treat the slaves as Americans. You know, we treated them
Yeah, that was a comfort.
Yeah, that was,
I remember,
yeah.
But I think the concept, again, would be, I'll be interested to look at what the Hebrew word is, because, again, slave, how the word slave as translated may not be hermeneutic the same thing. You see, servant might be quite a different thing. Extended family, you see. I think slave, I'd like to look at the Hebrew term and then see what that means. That's why I was asking if someone had a Hebrew text.
Last year, year before last, an interpretation, there was an article which suggested that the prophetic argument against the institution of slavery did not extend to repudiating the institution, but only modifying it so that the persons who were in that condition were treated better than, you know, slaves in America were. Mm-hmm. So the institution of slavery is given Old Testament sanction. And Abraham being the patriarch, the beginning of that, you know, it seems almost necessary to associate him with those basic institutions which run through. How would you respond
to that? Well, see, I think we're talking about a hermeneutical question. See, this is what I'm getting at. And I'm saying we are having Western hermeneutics superimposed upon
the evidence.
That's right, on the evidence. And I want to look for the evidence.
Yeah.
Thank you. I thought I heard two suppositions. One, that you were dealing with the Old Testament as history. Two, right?
No.
No? Okay. Well, I thought I heard that you were dealing with roots as history.
No.
Okay. No. Well, why the statement treatment as history?
Right.
Is the treatment is historical.
Historical is different from saying, I said his methodology. I said his methodology was historical rather than systematic.
Okay, so then you are not saying this is a history of Alex, of, you're not saying this is a treatment of Alex Haley's family then.
No. What I'm saying is that you have a historical methodology which deals with events and sequences. That's what I meant by historical methodology.
But that's not historical.
And that's not, but that's, say what?
I just wondered if you had tried that out on some historians, because I don't think they would see that as historical methodology.
Well, maybe I need to be informed by you.
Well, let me ask this, Dave. Let me follow up Leon's question. If I understood what you were saying, the point, I'm sorry, I didn't get it all, but to know one's past, I think I heard you say, to know one's past is the key to one's identity.
Yeah.
And somehow you were treating this, say, historical methodology as a way of helping us know our past.
Yes.
So that you were investing it with historical value.
No, because I was not trying to say that the historical data had to be accurately or had to be definable.
No, this is an interpretation.
Exactly.
Interpretation of the past. Yeah.
Well, that's probably just not stated clearly enough. A number of the statements which you use, because you said treatment is, by saying treatment is historical, then by saying is indicative, and I thought contradictions. I thought that perhaps more precisely you could make clear what you're not doing.
Yeah. When we push that, I'm interested
in
what may you, I think.
Well, historians just don't take roots as any kind of historical study.
Oh, well, I'm not either.
It is very confusing when you throw terms around, such as, and that's all I'm suggesting.
Well, you say then that all roots are doing is just producing myths.
Yeah, that's
myth making.
No, I guess the definition of what you mean by myth, you see, I would say this, I would use, whether this is used by historian, I guess I come from my discipline of Old Testament, we talk about a novella, which would have historical data that might be interpreted for its value. And I would see roots as being novella in that sense. I think there are historical data that he uses, but I think that you cannot say that everything that he said happened the way he said it. You see, so if I were using a kind of I don't know how this would apply to modern historical writings, but in terms of the genre I would use in the Old Testament, it is novella. And of course, in my understanding of the patriarchal tradition, we're talking about Nepal. You know, you've got Von Braun and others who would even suggest that wouldn't do it among lay people, though, that there is no such thing as the patriarchs in a literal sense. That's what I'm talking about. What they suggest in terms of the saga that's connected with their lives. And I think this is what Haley is doing. I think Haley is taking historical data and, in an imaginative way, weaving a tale that relates Black Americans here today with the past.
And at the same time, yeah, though, would you argue, Dave, that this need to posit freedom in the beginning needs to be based upon, should be based upon something other than sentimental? For example, in terms of the African thing, I gathered that what you were really saying was that in point of fact, from a historical point of view, we know ourselves to have once been free.
Yes.
Now, what Roots does is simply to dramatize that and in a literary way.
Right.
It doesn't add anything to our historical knowledge of our freedom.
Yeah.
It simply makes us aware again of it because we might have lost the consciousness of it. Is that
I think you're right. And this is why I alluded to the people like Wesley and others who had established that very point. See, Haley did not establish the fact that Black people were free in Africa before, you know, they came here. I think what he did was to dramatize. I think you're right. You know, I think, but I think it entered the consciousness at a level that Wesley's work did not.
Did not.
And I think that is significant. And this is why I'm saying it calls for a kind of a hermeneutical understanding of what Roots really does, you say.
Shannon?
Yes.
I'm not so sure I'm permitted to speak. I'm just
we'll make an exception.
Right on. No, the quotation that you mentioned from D.H. Lawrence's works about the old order is supposed to be destroyed and a new order is supposed to be used to supplant it and so on.
Mm-hmm.
How does that actually fit into the mold of the Roots saga and the whole epic thrust of Roots?
Mm-hmm.
In a time when we don't seem to be making any kind of preparation for the, you know, to fill the gap, so to speak. If you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, I would see this. I was trying to tie that in again with my understanding what happened in 621 BC with the reforms with Ezra. And Ezra did not create the law. What he did was to interpret the law. He became the interpreter. And what I would see Roots doing, you see, is forming a continuum in which we as Black people began to actually coalesce around an understanding of freedom that we really have not appropriated. You see, now, when you begin to talk about the historical research that Carter D. Woodson gave his life to, and you talk about Ann Jane, who still feels that she is inferior, you see, that she won't even have a Black doctor because, you see, she's not going to trust her body with a Black doctor. You've got a gap between a reality in history and a practice today. And I'm saying that maybe Roots says, hey, you know, there is something beautiful about the history of this people. There is a reality that Black doctor can serve you as well as that white doctor. You follow me?
Yeah.
And I'm saying this calls for a new way of perceiving. This is what I mean by the quote from D.H. Lawrence. A new way of perceiving that is not a destruction of the reality that we encounter, but an affirmation of it. You see, he says what? That we ought to keep, you know, that we can't destroy. What we need to do is to encourage that root, that shoot to emerge. And I'm saying, this is maybe what our job is.
Yeah, my encounter with the people who actually deal with the whole story of Roots, my impression is that the tendency is just to romanticize the whole thing, you know, it just is, and that's all.
Yeah.
We don't seem to move beyond that point.
Well, I don't know. I guess my experience has been a little different, and I guess I'm coming from father of three teenagers who are in three different classes. And my daughter was the editorial page at her high school, all white high school. She happened to be the only Black there. But that school is never going to treat Black history the same because Roots served as a kind of entree to actually dealing with a lot of things about Black folk that the school had not dealt with. Now, maybe other schools have all had already included that in their curriculum. But I'm saying in a lot of suburban schools, you know, blacks were not even on the agenda of the curriculum.
So and they're being taken off now, too.
Well, not
already
a personal,
in many places. Oh, yes, they are.
But this is your point. I think that what you're saying is that it cannot be romanticized, and that when parents see that point of intro, of entree, they've got to keep pushing. If I'm hearing your
yeah,
question.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
John, what I'm saying.
Yeah, I wanted
Cornell,
to,
then Borkin, then Isaac, then
I say that you, the Garrett faculty, I don't know whether you're familiar with it, did a piece on the, what is it called, Murray?
Theological Response to Roots.
You
may want,
yeah.
Okay, I didn't know whether. The thing I wanted to say was, apropos of what Cornell was mentioning about myth, and I've been particularly interested in this in the context of the black experience. And it is very difficult now to write myth in the classical context. And I was curious as to what extent Haley's work is, the analogies you were drawing were interesting to me, because there is a mythological relationship between Abraham and the Genesis story.
Yes.
Of the creation. And so it really says, where have we come from? Mm-hmm. Not just in the sense of a generational question, but it's an ultimate question.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a question of which myth always explains.
Mm-hmm.
And it forms a kind of link between the beginning and explains to some extent where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was very helpful that Haley seems to have been able in the 1970s to create what I consider to be a unique modern myth. I don't know, the only point that's missing is that he does not, there isn't that prior link that I find in the Old Testament. It's implicit, but it isn't as explicit. So when you started with Abraham, I said, gee, that's interesting, but that is not where the Old Testament myth really begins.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, but you correctly started it where Haley. I thought that was fascinating.
And let me respond to that, because you see, what I'm trying to get at is a kind of an approach that I developed to the Old Testament, and that is that the Old Testament itself is a combination of hermeneutics. And then I look at the different recensions and the different documents and all as evidence of different hermeneutical developments of that experience of God. You know, this is what I kind of argued in my book. Now, I'm using the same thing to say that when you talk about Haley again, using myth in your word, in your sense, what I could appropriate,
right.
You see, that Haley is actually given a hermeneutic, you see, of the experience of his family, but he's not actually systematizing this history. He's dramatizing it. We as theologians or as conceptual thinkers, we've got to do what we've got to look at those dramatic events and make some type of order. You know, what is the doctrine of God? And you really could look at some of the basic loci of theology and then ask, what is his anthropology? You know, what is his sense of salvation? I mean, I've got another piece that I'm doing on that, because I think you can look at the theological loci and maybe extract from what he's done some of these things.
I just thought that it was interesting to me that in the black experience, and especially in black liberation theology, we constantly go to the Old Testament myth to get analogies,
right.
Because we don't have a indigenized one that we can, you know. And it's interesting that Haley, I don't believe that. Maybe this is serendipity. Haley may have intended to do this in terms of his own family. But you were right when you said, this is every man. I didn't think of that in universal terms,
mm-hmm.
as much as I thought of every man in the context of the black experience.
Yeah.
Period.
Could I just jump in before we move to that? You want to get on that? Another question.
Another question.
Well, let me push this if I may. And I want to address it both to you and John.
Yeah.
Could he have written that in the 60s? Would it have found the same kind of response from you all that he found in the 70s? I'm just wondering whether the old Philippian notion about the broken symbols and whenever they lose their usefulness and the creation of myths. Is there not a time, the time in which we find ourselves,
I think you're right,
makes that somehow commend itself to us? And I was curious about you associating that with the Deuteronomic reform.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the 60s, we're talking about revolution, you know. And it's not accidental.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's not accidental that is the direction our consciousness moves in at that point.
Good point.
I think that Roots can be read as a typical American romance, a kind of black application of the racial algebra mystique writ large. It ends on optimism. No talk about social structures in terms of how the contemporary blacks in the end are being incorporated in. The emphasis on struggle is always in the past, which has been overcome. It began with the Edenic innocence and the fall. Typical American novel. I mean, it's no surprise why Americans would fall in love with it. Because he's successful, and his success, of course, is at the very end of the novel. He's overcome. And that's what I think is the fallacy, and that's the real myth of the negative.
Right. And the destructive. Now, that's the destructive aspect of the myth.
And I think that goes hand in hand with the ideology of the 70s.
That's right. Yeah. Always how many millions he made from it.
This is why I'm saying that you've got to have a hermeneutic that can tease out that kind of thing. We get away from the romanticizing that I think you were talking about. I think you're right. That this is what I mean by we can't overreact to the event. I mean, be overtaken by we're in trouble.
I just think we would have eaten that thing up and spit it out if they come out in the 60s. That's all I'm saying. In the sense that it does suggest that all of our struggle is yesterday.
And
Haley represents us finding the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. You know, every boy can be president. Everybody can be a captain of industry. You know, this
but,
kind
but
of
Herb,
thing.
But Herb, the Old Testament, just the analogy, the Old Testament, the crowning point of the myth is reaching the Canaan, reaching the promised land. And I find that analogy just fascinating because in a certain sense, myth cannot go beyond a certain point without then so impinging on the existential moment that it loses all of its vitality.
Yeah, it becomes
problematic. If it starts getting in the room with us.
You're absolutely right. But see, you know what happened? When you end it there,
right,
on the entrance into Canaan,
mm-hmm,
then you are not fooled.